Good morning and welcome to the Talking Information Center. Today is Saturday, August 22nd, and we have today's reading of the Boston Globe being read to you by John Garnier. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Billy, and good morning to everyone. Our first story, A Shift on Harvard Avenue. This is by Karina Chung, a Globe correspondent. The one-time home of Alston's legendary Great Scott Music Review is now a Taco Bell. The former Twin Donuts is becoming Boston's newest Blank Street Coffee. On Harvard Avenue, decades-long tenants of the Gordon Building are fleeing steep rent increases. The area in Alston surrounding Harvard Avenue, a core of college life, is experiencing a jarring change. The commercial district has seen more business closings this year than at any time since the COVID-19 shutdown. It's mostly smaller, locally owned businesses closing with few clues on what will replace them. Even for Great Scott, plans to revive the historic venue are stalled because of rising construction costs. The trend has community leaders and remaining local owners worried that the neighborhood's local youth-driven artistic character is seeping away. When we lose these destination businesses, it's like cutting the main roots, Alston Village Main Street's president, Scott Matalon, said. They feed the rest of the neighborhood. It's a dilemma other neighborhoods have faced. Boston's rising real estate values mean retail space is increasingly pricey. Landlords often charge substantially more than longtime tenants are paying. And that trend only accelerates as existing owners cash out. Alston, affectionately known as Rat City by residents for the innumerable rodents living among them, is no exception. There are rumors, too, of Blanchard's liquor store closing, originating from a now-deleted Reddit post. Chris Corey, owner of the decades-old Alston establishment on Harvard and Brighton Avenues, has not responded to multiple requests for comment, including a call where he abruptly hung up on a Globe reporter. Uncertainty and unease over Alston's commercial future have escalated since the sale of the Gordon Building, a hub for small independent businesses. Previously owned by the Gordon family, the building at 149 to 175 Harvard Ave was bought by Alpha Management Corp in June, adding around two dozen sites to the nearly 20 storefronts that property records indicated already owns on the street. Alpha started raising rents, tripling some. Long-tenured stores, such as the Pet Shop, are selling stock and preparing to move out. Others, including Regeneration Tattoo, have already shuttered. Alpha's communication with neighborhood business organizations has been minimal, said Ben Franco, president of the Alston Brighton Chamber of Commerce. I've not heard the new owners articulate a vision for what they expect to be in the new Gordon Building going forward and who they're looking to attract as retail tenants, Franco said. Alpha attorney and spokesperson Bob Allen said in an email that many Gordon tenants are still paying rents below Harvard Avenue averages of $40 to $60 per square foot per year. At the top end, that's a rate that rivals Boston's primary busiest thoroughfares, a 2025 report from commercial real estate firm CBRE found. Rents that high simply aren't sustainable for most local entrepreneurs, said Jordan Warshaw, a real estate developer and Great Scott project partner. You see it all over the place where a new landlord comes in and they see the opportunity to raise the rent, Warshaw said. Warshaw said landlords typically prefer businesses capable of paying their rent for many years with a proven track record. And on Harvard Avenue, newer openings increasingly consist of bigger, better-known groups and franchisees and not untested small businesses. New openings also reflect changing demographics in the neighborhood, where the student population draws heavily from China and Asia with large Asian-American contingent. Instead of McDonald's or Chipotle, it's Korean fried chicken chains and overseas boba brands making their mark. Surviving local businesses also tend to target Asian customers. Multiple Korean restaurants opened this year. The Boston-based group behind Cafe Weekend on Harvard Avenue recently opened two spots, Sanbada and Jinji, in the former Tavern in the Square location on Brighton Avenue. Those openings, however, come amid a broader retreat by Korean-owned businesses, with rising prices eroding a longtime cultural foothold for Korean Americans. Mike Lee, president of Boston's OKTA, Korean Business Association, and owner of Novo Marketplace restaurant, Korean Village, said interest in Korean culture helps businesses like his. But his business partner and fellow vice president, Sun Jang Park, acknowledged that they struggle to compete with new entrants. I was a Koreatown before, but right now Chinese people are more interested in opening businesses here, real estate broker Coco Kwan said. Kwan has worked in Austin for about a decade. Much of her clientele consists of out-of-state Chinese restaurants expanding into Boston and franchisees of international Chinese brands, including Molly Tea and Hey Tea. She's also the agent for a Chinese boba chain looking to fill the empty storefront on 130 Brighton Ave, once home to Shubaila, a California-based retailer for Asian lifestyle products. A generational shift in consumer behavior also contributes to the broad shift. Fewer young adults are drinking and going out, and much of Austin's commercial activity is fueled by its oversized 18 to 30 population. Many bars that once attracted lines down the streets, Tavern, Wonder Bar, White Horse Tavern, closed during or after the pandemic and are now subdivided into restaurant spaces. The most recent closure, the Draft Bar and Grill, sits empty after meeting an unceremonious end when the owner's liquor license was revoked in January for underage drinking. Carlos Cucina Italiana owner and Austin native Bryant Rodriguez witnessed the change firsthand. He could recall working at the restaurant as late as 2 a.m. and walking home through people still on the streets. We used to stay open till 11 on the weekends, Rodriguez said. There's nobody coming in after 10 o'clock anymore. Even the number of students patronizing businesses is shrinking. Rodriguez isn't the only restaurant owner who said they've seen less international student foot traffic since the Trump administration's student visa restrictions. Rodriguez has sought out alternative clients to pay his $6,000 rent. Carlos caters meals for Harvard and BU's athletic teams, which helps cover a large portion. If you don't adapt, you're not going to go far, Rodriguez said. Great Scott was also a casualty of the pandemic, but plans to revive the venue as a mixed-use building on Harvard Avenue persist. Project partners Warshaw, Great Scott booking manager Carl Lavin, and music company chief executive Paul Armstrong were aiming for a groundbreaking soon after approval from the Boston Planning Board last September, but high construction costs and economic uncertainty have prevented meaningful progress. For Lavin, the project represents the crossroads of a new development and the old Alston, something he hopes the venue maintains. As the neighborhood changes, it adds a different flavor to everything, Lavin said. What we want to do is do what we do and provide that in the neighborhood for as long as the neighborhood allows. He shares that hope with others on Harvard Avenue, but few seem sure of what will come next or how the neighborhood will look in coming years. Madelon said he sees the changes and envisions the streets looking more like other historic commercial hubs in the area, made up more by restaurant groups and chain retailers over independent businesses. I think we're just getting priced out, Madelon said. Everyone's afraid that they're going to try and turn us into another Harvard Square or another Kenmore Square. Next up, Doctor Testifies on Words to Children. This is by Shelley Murphy and Leah Skeen of the Globe staff. This story may contain content readers find disturbing or triggering. Dateline Plymouth. For the first time in the triple murder trial of Lindsay Clancy, jurors heard what she said to her children before killing them. Go to God. The chilling scene was described by a psychiatrist testifying for the prosecution on Friday, who said Clancy described the murder scene when he interviewed her in custody several months ago. The psychiatrist, Dr. Avram Mack, testified as an expert witness for the prosecution. He was hired by the Plymouth District Attorney's Office to evaluate Clancy's claim She was suffering from postpartum psychosis. His testimony came from two interviews of Clancy at Tewksbury Hospital in April. Separately, in a civil lawsuit she filed against her practitioners, Clancy acknowledged using the same phrase during the killings. Clancy has admitted she strangled 5-year-old Cora, 3-year-old Dawson, and 8-month-old Callan after sending her husband out to pick up medication and takeout for dinner. She then slashed her neck and wrists and jumped out a second-story window in a failed suicide attempt. She's paralyzed from the waist down and appears in court each day in a wheelchair. She's pleaded not guilty to murder, asserting she was in the throes of postpartum psychosis at the time and should not be held criminally responsible. Jurors who may get the case early next week must decide whether Clancy, 36, suffered from a mental health condition that made her unable to appreciate the wrongfulness of her actions or unable to conform them to the requirements of the law. To that end, jurors on Friday heard dueling perspectives from two psychiatrists over whether Clancy suffered from psychosis when she killed her children and was unable to resist a voice in her head. Earlier in the day, the jury heard from the last witness for Clancy's defense, Dr. Philip Resnick, a forensic psychiatrist with expertise in postpartum conditions, who's testified in other high-profile murder and insanity cases. Resnick said he evaluated Clancy 4 months after the slayings and concluded she was suffering from postpartum psychosis when she killed her children. He said she was experiencing command hallucinations and a delusion of influence, the sense of losing control over your body. She felt that her body was taken over by an external force, he said. It was almost like she was a puppet and someone else was pulling the strings. Resnick said he met with Clancy for several hours in May 2023, interviewed her parents, and reviewed her medical records as well as police reports. Given that she had been displaying symptoms of mild mania, Resnick said his final diagnosis was bipolar disorder with major depression. His assessment supports a defense theory that Clancy's many mental health providers who treated her for postpartum anxiety and insomnia failed to properly diagnose her or prescribe appropriate medications in the months before she killed her children. Instead, the defense has argued, they kept prescribing her psychiatric medications, some of which likely exacerbated her symptoms. Separately, Mack, who was the first rebuttal witness for the prosecution, testified Clancy has been taking medication for bipolar disorder at Tewksbury Hospital, where she's being held and receiving treatment. Resnick said the killings in this case meet his definition of altruistic filicide, which is a murder committed out of love rather than hostility. Clancy was obsessive about caring for her children, as the jury has heard from her family members and others, the doctor said. In her mind, she believed that she would be doing her children a favor by having them go to heaven with her rather than remaining on earth without her, he testified. With her distorted, psychotic thinking, she did what she believed was morally right, he added. Resnick also testified in the case of Andrea Yates, a Texas mother who was initially convicted of murder for drowning her 5 children in 2001, then was acquitted by reason of insanity after she was granted a retrial. In Clancy's case, Resnick rebutted the prosecution's argument that she was in control of her actions because she hadn't previously shown any clear signs of psychosis. He also said she likely could have downplayed her symptoms because she was scared of having her children taken away. Even just hours before the killings, Clancy wasn't frankly psychotic every minute of the day, Resnick said. She built a snowman with her children and took her daughter to the doctor, for an annual checkup, a level of functioning that she indicated wasn't psychotic until the command hallucination began, he continued. When Mack took the stand for the prosecution, however, he presented a different argument. He testified that, in his opinion, Clancy was suffering from major depressive disorder, not psychosis. He said she methodically killed her children, even though she knew it was wrong. He said she should have done more to stop herself before harming them. While depressed, her mental state was relatively stable, Mack said. He said she displayed normal thinking, the ability to think ahead and navigate the world. For example, he said Clancy followed the rules of the road when she drove her daughter to the doctor just hours before the killings, showing she was able to act in accordance with the law. Mack also acknowledged that sometimes people display improved mood immediately before they attempt suicide. Since the trial began in late July, jurors have heard a number of witnesses testify that Clancy was desperately seeking help for postpartum depression and anxiety beginning in September 2022. Her struggles intensified when she faced the prospect of returning to work as a labor and delivery nurse at Massachusetts General Hospital. Now, the focus inside the courtroom has shifted to the opinions of mental health experts who've reviewed the evidence. During cross-examination of Mack, defense attorney Kevin Reddington challenged the doctor's credentials, suggesting he has little experience treating postpartum patients. Much of his work is focused on child and adolescent mental health, addiction, and other areas of research, Reddington said. Mack countered that he sees himself as a generalist who happens to have a couple of areas of focus. Where in here does it say that you ever came within breathing distance of a pregnant woman? Reddington asked, reading from a record of Mack's professional experience and research publications. During direct examination, Mack said he hadn't considered postpartum conditions in his evaluation of Clancy, citing guidelines limiting the postpartum period to 4 weeks after birth. Other experts have rejected that definition, with some saying it can last a year or more. On Monday, Mack will resume testifying. Prosecutors are expected to call several more witnesses moving forward. Closing arguments may take place as early as Tuesday. Okay, next up. For Lynch, a challenge in the 8th District. This is by Anjale Hunya of the Globe staff. To active Democrats in Boston and its southern suburbs, the primary for the 8th Congressional District is one of the most exciting races in years. Voters' mailboxes are filling with campaign flyers. And at a time when dissatisfaction with long-serving incumbents is running high, some polls show the challenger closing in. You just wouldn't know it from watching the incumbent, Stephen Lynch, actually campaign. We're in good shape, the South Boston Democrat said last week, smiling with confidence and nonchalance after a candidate forum in Weymouth, his first with challenger Patrick Roth at his this cycle. I think we'll be happy with the result. For Lynch, 71, a contested primary is not new. But Roth, a 39-year-old attorney and former Deval Patrick aide, is trying to exploit a restive Democratic base, anxious for fresh voices in Washington, accusing the more moderate Lynch of clinging to politics of the past and aiming to energize voters in ways his progressive predecessors hadn't, despite many not knowing his name even a year ago. Lynch has at times responded publicly with a metaphorical yawn. He's held relatively few formal campaign events beyond door-knocking, official appearances, and supporters waving signs on his behalf. The incumbent has largely ignored Roth's demand for more debates, and has dismissed Roth, who lives in Jamaica Plain, as a transplant because he grew up in Connecticut. Still, Lynch's campaign on Thursday reported spending nearly $700,000 since the start of July, most of it on advertising, including a recent spot that features him jogging and drawing down his campaign account by more than half. Additionally, a dozen local Democratic town committee leaders told the Globe they sense Lynch is struggling to adapt to changing demographics in his South Shore anchored district, pointing to an influx of younger, more liberal voters, or to reconcile his past positions, such as his opposition to the Affordable Care Act 16 years ago, that are at odds with the party's increasingly liberal views. Some said they also want a representative who can bring the fight, fight, fight attitude against President Trump, they feel, has been lacking in the party. folks are feeling the vibe nationally within the Democratic Party. There's a lot of progressive excitement, said Megan Haggerty, chair of the Milton Democratic Town Committee, who hasn't endorsed a candidate. But she also is not blind to the dynamics here. Incumbents are hard to unseat. A lot of people know Congressman Lynch, Haggerty said. It seems competitive, and I think it's a toss-up right now. Lynch, for his part, has been dismissive of his challenger's odds, telling the Globe he had staved off previous progressive challengers with more money and more of a buzz around them. In 2020, for instance, Lynch topped Robbie Goldstein, now the state's public health commissioner, beating him by more than 30 percentage points. He also easily beat two primary challengers in 2018. Neither Roth nor any of those candidates, Lynch said, had his experience over 12-plus terms in Congress. In an hour-long forum last week in Weymouth, Lynch cited his position as the ranking Democrat on a subcommittee on artificial intelligence, his work securing affordable housing and hospital funding for the district, and his labor support as a former iron worker. The experience versus new blood argument, Lynch told the Globe, is a perennial choice, one he himself used when he first ran for Congress as a quarter century ago, winning a special Democratic primary on September 11th, 2001. In a sign of how that's changed, Lynch quoted one of my predecessors, John Adams, who served as a delegate for Massachusetts in the First Continental Congress, in his closing remarks last Thursday, saying, "Facts are stubborn things. We've got a pretty young Congress right now, so I think you need a balance," Lynch said. "The average U.S. House member is about 58 years old. You need some people who've been there a while, and you need some new blood, too, and we've got plenty of that right now." That hasn't stopped Lynch from being a target. National news outlets have labeled Lynch as an incumbent at risk of losing to a left-wing challenger. Roth has outraised Lynch, pulling in $1.1 million to Lynch's $817,000 from when he entered the race through June. Leaders We Deserve, the PAC headed by gun control advocate David Hogg, has sent at least four mailers on Roth's behalf in about as many weeks, dubbing Lynch MAGA's favorite Democrat, and Roth as the candidate who knows how to fight back for us. The PAC has circulated polling showing Roth within 7 percentage points of Lynch. In February, Roth's own campaign polling showed Lynch with a 26 percentage point lead. Congressman Lynch has, no question, a solid base, but it's a shrinking base, said Bob Binney, chair of the Ward 5 committee, rooted in downtown Boston, which has endorsed Roth. Everyone wants more stand-up people down in Congress, and they don't see that out of Lynch. Lynch is pushing a very different message. A mailer from his campaign framed him as the sensible choice in the middle, asking voters, "When the political extremes drown everyone out, who's listening to you?" Sandwiched between images of two people yelling. In a recent appearance on GBH's Boston Public Radio, Lynch likened himself to former President Joe Biden, whose success was his ability to capture the people who elected me, the moderates. "We need more people in the middle to give that strength to the Democrats so that we can actually be a party that governs, and not simply a party of protesters against the party in power," Lynch said. The racist dynamic has Democrats divided in places such as Hull, where the co-chairs of the Democratic Town Committee are split. One's backing Roth, wanting someone young and energetic. The other is staying with Lynch, citing his labor support. Lynch's union backers, who have stayed with him for years, argue his blue-collar background has made him a champion for workers in Congress. "There's a difference between age and being ineffective, and age and knowledge and being effective. And I think Congressman Lynch is effective," said Chrissy Brady, a Braintree resident and office manager with North Atlantic State's Regional Council of Carpenters, who was among 50 people who waved signs for Lynch outside last week's forum. To Crystal Kelly, the Hingham Democratic Town Committee Chair, "Lynch is just a regular guy," which she said resonates with the working families that I've talked to. To be sure, Lynch also pitches himself as an active Trump antagonist. His campaign sent a mailer advertising Lynch's co-sponsorship of bills to check immigration enforcement. On August 14, Lynch made an unannounced stop at the Plymouth County Correctional Facility, where detained immigrants are held alongside Representatives Jim McGovern and Ayanna Pressley, neither of whom endorsed the 8th District race. Some Democrats, however, say they want members of Congress to also bring new perspectives, including those from raising a young family like Roth. I'm not saying that Stephen Lynch didn't do that, but his understanding of what life is like for working people is outdated at best, said Amanda Colligan, co-chair of the East Bridgewater Democratic Town Committee. That momentum is exactly what Roth is hoping to capitalize on. During the candidate forum in Weymouth, the only time during this race the two have faced one another on stage, Roth repeatedly decried the politics of the past and referred to Lynch as a career elected official since I was about 5 years old. We can't trust that the system that got us here is going to continue to deliver, said Roth, a first-time candidate who has criticized Lynch as insufficiently left-leaning on issues including health care, immigration, and abortion policy. What some voters are taking note of, however, are events where Lynch hasn't been present. At a senior picnic hosted this month by Brockton Council on Aging, Roth distributed meals and campaign paraphernalia to 300 seniors. There he met Freddie Walker, an 85-year-old Brockton resident, who told him she had initially planned to vote for Lynch in her mail-in ballot that week, but would instead go for Roth. Life goes forward, not backwards, Walker said. Nothing to do with Lynch on a personal level. I just don't think that he's relevant for this particular time. Next up, tricky treks can mean steep bills for hikers needing help in New Hampshire. This is by Ariella Lopez, a Globe correspondent. A recent rescue of four teenage hikers on Franconia Ridge in the White Mountains has sparked wide interest, but less so for the drama of the nighttime operation and more so for the fact that New Hampshire intends to bill them for the cost. A 2015 New Hampshire law allows the state Fish and Game Department to bill rescued hikers who were determined to have acted negligently by failing to prepare for their trek. The state is one of just a few, including Maine, Oregon, and California, where agencies can seek to recover the cost of a rescue operation from the person or group who needed it. Colonel Kevin Jordan, who leads the department's law enforcement arm, called the case to bill the teens as an obvious one based on their apparent lack of preparation. The four 18-year-olds embarked on a strenuous hike that can take upwards of 7 hours to complete at 3:30 p.m. without packing headlamps, warm clothing, or enough water. About 5 hours in, they called for help. They didn't know where they were, Jordan said in a phone interview this week. It was pretty bad. Advik Yadav, one of the rescued hikers, said in an interview with NBC4 New York, he was grateful to the rescuers who spent nearly 8 hours guiding them back to the trailhead before 9 the next morning. You should start like really early so it's not dark when you go down, and you shouldn't be very overconfident, Tirth Shah, another rescued hiker, told the television station. Janam Bafar, a third hiker, declined to be interviewed Wednesday, saying the group of friends had decided not to comment further. Jordan said the department bills hikers in about 12 of around 180 search and rescue operations it conducts each year. The charge covers the hourly wages for responding department officers, plus the cost of using equipment like cruisers or aircraft, he said. That usually totals between $1,000 and $20,000. Deciding whether a hiker was unprepared enough to be billed comes down, in Jordan's words, to common sense. Fish and Game officers interviewed the rescued hikers to determine if they had the right gear and heated weather and safety advisories Then it's up to Jordan to decide whether a hiker was negligent based on the officer's report and an inventory of the hiker's equipment. It's not like you're looking in a pack, and if I don't see a compass, you're going to get a bill, he said. It's if you don't have a pack, or you don't have any warm clothes, or went up in a snowstorm and don't even have boots. Once Jordan makes his recommendation, the state Justice Department's Environmental Protection Bureau gets a final say. The New Jersey teens have not been billed yet. Jordan said he hasn't billed a hiker who had to be rescued because of an injury or billed the family of a hiker who died. In the case of the four teens, one hiker reported sore legs and trouble breathing. Hikers can appeal the bill or even sue in civil court if their appeal is denied, Jordan said, but it doesn't happen often. Bart Zienkowitz, 36, of Florida, said he was billed about $1,000 after he and a friend got lost in a blizzard on Franconia Ridge in 2025 and called for a rescue. Zienkowitz, who then lived in Connecticut, said he was thankful to be rescued and did not appeal the bill. If it was double, I still would have paid it, he said in a phone interview Wednesday. The billing program started more than a decade ago when the New Hampshire Fish and Game Department was wrestling with the costs of its search and rescue efforts, Jordan said. For years, that budget was covered by sales of state fishing licenses. A cell service on the trails improved and the number of hikers increased. The department found itself fielding more rescue calls from hikers lacking proper gear. Jeb Bradley, a former state senator who co-sponsored the billing program legislation and who hiked all 48 of New Hampshire's 4,000 footers a dozen times each in the early 2010s, said he often saw people on the trails without headlamps or winter hiking boots. You saw that kind of lack of preparation a significant amount of the time, said Bradley, 73. I was always somebody that felt if you were negligent, if you didn't have the proper gear, if you were pushing the weather conditions or whatever, then because other people's lives are at risk going out and trying to rescue people, they should bill you. Search and rescue operations cost New Hampshire Fish and Game about $389,000 in the fiscal year that ended in July, Jordan said. Much of that is funded through sales of the department's Hike Safe cards, which also started in 2015. The cards cost hikers $25 a year and are marketed as insurance against a bill for a rescue. Still, cardholders can be fined if it's determined they were especially irresponsible, Jordan said. He said the department sold $444,000 worth of cards in 2025. The Hike Safe card is really a kind of donation, said Paul Cormier, president of the Volunteer Mountain Rescue Service. For all the work the state does, most of the people who climb, trek, and drive through the New Hampshire wilderness to recover stranded hikers are volunteers who work on teams funded by donations and grants. The teams include people in their 20s to some even in their 80s. Some are retired, but many work full-time jobs. The volunteers mobilize whenever Fish and Game alerts them to lost or injured hikers. Members of the Pemigewasset Valley Search and Rescue Team assisted when the four teenagers called for help, according to Fish and Game. Jamie Bernard, the team's president, declined to share specifics about the rescue, citing the hikers' ages. Jordan said their rescue was one of nine Fish and Game responded to that weekend. Daniel Lampignano, 46, who heads the New England Canine Search and Rescue Team, thinks the number of rescue calls has risen in recent years as New Hampshire's trails grow more popular and social media inspires less experienced hikers to try challenging trails. Rescue calls seem to have increased, and the type of rescue calls has more often involved individuals who are far less prepared to be outside, he said. Volunteer rescuers are not involved in decisions about whether to bill hikers, nor are they allowed to speculate about the circumstances of rescues, Bernard said. We learned a long time ago not to try to judge people, Cormier of Martin Rescue Service said. We let the Fish and Game do that. Next up. Colorless honored. Pair of plaids mark Scott's visit. This is by Camillo Fonseca of the Globe staff. Boston couldn't get enough of Scottish World Cup fans. The Tartan Army drank the town dry, crowned statues with traffic cones, and bravely whooshed down the cop slide in kilts. The admiration was mutual and strong enough that Mayor Michelle Wu announced plans to make Boston and Glasgow sister cities. Susan Aitken, leader of the Glasgow City Council, called the move a fantastic gesture from our friends in Boston. Now Boston and the Scots will get further entwined. A shopping mall in Glasgow unveiled its own bespoke tartan, the traditional woven fabric used for kilts and shawls, in honor of the city's twinning with Boston. A ceremonial kilt made with the new tartan will be presented to Boston when the two cities celebrate their agreement, Buchanan Galleries said in a statement last week. The event, dubbed Tartan Day, is expected to take place in April. The presentation will formally celebrate the long and storied history between Glasgow and Boston as two major North Atlantic port cities over the last 400 years, while recognizing the role Scotland supporters played in bringing the two cities even closer together during the recent FIFA World Cup, read the statement. But while the Buchanan Gallery's tartan may have the endorsement of Scotland's largest city, it's not the only design to honor the Tartan Army's hosts across the pond. The same day Buchanan unveiled its design, a group of Scottish soccer fans posted their own Boston-inspired tartan on social media. We've been working away in the background on this one for a couple of months now, and we're absolutely delighted to finally reveal the samples of our new tartan, New Scotland, Massachusetts, the Northeast Tartan Army wrote in its post. You don't need to be an expert in Scottish Highland dress to see that the two tartans don't look much alike. The Buchanan Gallery's pattern features fields of sapphire blue with flecks of yellow and green in honor of Fenway Park. The Northeast tartan, on the other hand, is dark blue with streaks of crimson red, consciously evoking the colors of the Red Sox and the New England Patriots. It may seem as if choosing a tartan is simply a matter of personal preference, yet, going by Scottish history, it's anything but. The patterns aren't just symbols of a country's cultural heritage. They're regulated by the Scottish government, which sets strict requirements as to their naming, design, and even thread count. Traditional tartans reflect different regional and clan identities, many forged over hundreds of years. Take the centuries-old blood feud between the Campbells and the MacDonalds, famously parodied in an episode of Mad Men. Even today, it's hard to imagine a MacDonald with tartans of dark green, red, and dark blue ever choosing to wear a Campbell tartan of dark blue and dark green. But Chris Gibson, who helped draft the Northeast tartan, said he's not worried his design will spark another clan war. Yes, both new designs were conceived at roughly the same time, and both are woven in appreciation of the Tartan Army's unofficial Massachusetts home. But Gibson, who serves as the fan group's vice chair, takes a practical view. Theirs is a different color, different name. In a way, the two designs mirror the unique identities woven into tartans of old. While Glasgow is Scotland's largest city and economic center, Gibson's home of Aberdeen is smaller and tucked away in the country's northern coast. It's like going from Boston to Portland, Maine. Though for Gibson, who charters buses on days the national team is playing, the trip is considerably longer. It's like 3.5 hours to Glasgow, he said. Every game is an away game for us, so we're dedicated fans. For the World Cup, Gibson was part of the Tartan Army contingent that traveled to Scotland's matches in Foxborough, splitting his 9 days here between Boston and Providence. His group also made the trek to Miami for Scotland's final group stage match, but it became clear there was something missing. South Florida, he said, was totally different. So when the group had the opportunity to go back to Boston before returning to Scotland, they jumped at it. When we landed, it was like we were kings or something, he said. We were getting rounds of applause for walking into a bar. just because we had our kilts on. We got so much love going back. For Scotland's next round of scheduled games, Gibson won't be boarding the bus in Aberdeen, but rather a plane back to Boston. In October, he and his mates plan to watch several of the national team's games in the UEFA Nations League tournament from here in Boston, and will bring several extra tartans to return the generosity. We'll have, I think, five in order, so we'll probably have a couple to wear, he said, but then we can maybe give them away as well, like to wear them to hand them over. That's the plan, anyway. The Buchanan Gallery's design will also make an appearance in Boston next year when members of the Glasgow City Council celebrate the official Sister City ceremony. A spokesperson for the Glasgow City Council said the Buchanan Gallery's tartan was a private endeavor, but added that the city is happy to support any organization and business that is seeking to strengthen the Boston-Glasgow relationship in a positive way. As we look to strengthen the already close ties between Glasgow and Boston, I hope it will become another symbol of the friendship and shared spirit that connects our two cities, said Bailey Christie Mearns, the council's deputy Lord Provost. The Buchanan Gallery's tartan has been formally recorded in the Scottish Register of Tartans, while Gibson said his design is in the process of being registered. But for all of the official requirements, the question of which tartan officially represents the Boston-Scotland relationship is a matter of perspective. I don't think we'll be the only two either, Gibson said. I think there'll be probably more, you know what I mean? The World Cup experience, he suggested, is one Scottish fans won't soon forget. It was quite spectacular what happened, he said. It was really hard to put into words. Okay. Next up, England's ancient oaks dying amid heat waves and drought. This is by Claire Moses of the New York Times, Dateline London. When Sally Kellard moved in 2018 to her home in Shropshire in the English countryside, the old oak tree near her front door had a vibrant canopy of leaves. In the 8 years since, the tree, the Crow Liasau oak, estimated to be about 1,000 years old, has withered nearly to death with only a single living bough remaining, Kellard said. To be living next to such an iconic tree is a real honor, said Kellard, who runs a bed and breakfast. To think we'd see his final demise is heartbreaking. The tree is thought to be one of up to 3,500 ancient oaks in England that are more than 600 years old. Many of these trees, which hold a significant place in English history, culture, and imagination, have been suffering in sweltering temperatures and consecutive years of drought, according to Ed Pine, a conservation advisor at the nonprofit Woodland Trust. The threat was underscored in June when the major oak in Sherwood Forest, perhaps the most famous tree in the country, estimated at 800 to 1,200 years old, died. Conservationists cited a combination of factors, including climate change and over-tourism. Pine said that the demise of the major oak was not unique. England is losing one or two such trees a year. England is at the tail end of one of its hottest summers on record, and the warming climate adds to the stress on trees, Pine said. This month, a wildfire at the New Forest, a national park in England, destroyed a significant number of ancient beech and oak trees, which have been standing at this site for hundreds of years, according to Forestry England, a government agency. Ancient trees are less resilient than younger ones. They often suffer from compaction around their roots because humans and animals have walked around them for hundreds of years, making it harder for the roots to absorb water. And the dry conditions mean there's less water on the ground anyway, said John Stokes, director of tree science and research at the Tree Council, a nonprofit in London. If you're an already stressed old tree and then you get a soil moisture deficit drought as well, it's not going to do you any huge favors, he said. The loss of ancient trees reverberates far beyond their surroundings because they house multiple species, said Pine, who described a tree as its own ecosystem. It's truly irreplaceable, Pine said. We know that we don't have the next generation of trees to replace these trees. Here are two of England's oldest and most noteworthy trees that experts say are in critical condition. The Ludlow Oak. This oak, one of the oldest trees in England, stands near the town of Ludlow, whose recorded history goes back to the 11th century, according to the local government. The nearby Ludlow Castle is where Henry VIII's older brother died, which led to Henry VIII becoming king. Kellard, who owns the 400-year-old house beside it, said local folklore holds that proposing under the ancient tree bodes well for a marriage. And the old Knobley Oak, this 800-year-old tree in Essex, northeast of London, potentially tells a lurid story. The area was home to Matthew Hopkins, who styled himself a witch hunter in the 17th century. Locals say that the tree was used as a hiding place by women he accused of being witches. Court cuts $50 million Sandy Hook judgment. This is by Jim Vertuno of the Associated Press, Dateline Austin. A Texas court on Friday slashed a $50 million judgment to about $6 million against InfoWars founder Alex Jones after he falsely claimed the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School mass shooting was a hoax. The ruling does not affect a $1.25 billion judgment against Jones in Connecticut, but is a legal victory for him after he and his company, Free Speech Systems, were found liable for damages for claiming the mass shooting didn't happen. Despite the multiple financial judgments against him in Connecticut and Texas, Jones has yet to make any payments as he appeals the amounts and the attempt to liquidate his company. The unanimous opinion by the Texas Third Court of Appeals left intact more than $4.1 million in compensatory damages awarded by a jury to Sandy Hook parents, Neil Heslin and Scarlett Lewis, for defamation and emotional distress. But the court slashed more than $45 million in additional punitive damages down to $1.5 million to comply with the state's $750,000 cap for each plaintiff. The court found that Heslin and Lewis did not show evidence that harassment that resulted from Jones's hoax claims rose to a level that would allow them to exceed the cap. It also said the trial judge improperly allowed the parents to seek higher damages after trial. Heslin and Lewis's six-year-old son Jesse Lewis was among 20 children and six educators killed in the attack in Newtown, Connecticut. The lawsuit and the 2022 verdict against Jones marked the first time he was held financially liable for peddling lies about the massacre, claiming it was faked by the government to tighten gun laws. Jones, who portrayed the lawsuit as an attack on his First Amendment rights, conceded during the trial that the attack was 100% real and that he was wrong to have lied about it. However, on his streaming show Friday, he called the Texas ruling a gigantic victory for the First Amendment and said he will continue to appeal the case to the state Supreme Court to get the remaining damages thrown out. I got lawyers who are good constitutional lawyers, and they're not backing down, Jones said. Mark Bankston, an attorney for Heslin and Lewis in Texas, shrugged off the appeals court ruling as irrelevant, given that Jones still faces massive financial judgments. The families care not at all about this irrelevant ruling, which affects only two of the 19 claims they all share. Jones still faces over $1 billion of liability, so this changes absolutely nothing. All it does is highlight the absurdity of Texas law, Bankston said. Heslin and Lewis told jurors in the case that an apology wouldn't suffice and called on them to make Jones pay for the years of suffering he's put them and the other Sandy Hook families through. At the Texas and Connecticut trials, victims' relatives testified that Jones's followers, believing his claims that the shooting didn't happen, subjected them to death and rape threats, in-person harassment, and abusive comments on social media. Jones argued there was no proof that linked him to those actions. Jones' trial attorney, Andino Reynal, said immediately after the verdict that Jones would appeal the damages amount and predicted it would be reduced to $1.5 million. Christopher Mattai, a lawyer for the Sandy Hook families in the Connecticut lawsuit, said Friday's ruling has no bearing on the ongoing lower court proceedings in Texas involving the liquidation of InfoWars' parent company. Fat Marmot Week shines a light on the alpine rodents. This is by Brittany Peterson and Mead Groover of the Associated Press. Dateline Gothic, Colorado. Last winter was tough for marmots living high in the Colorado mountains, where researchers say two-thirds of one population died while hibernating because of insufficient snow cover. Those that survived are doing well, fattening up in time not just for fall and hibernation season, but, drumroll please, the very first Fat Marmot Week. Just like Fat Bear Week, an online contest to vote for Alaskan brown bears plumped up for winter, Fat Marmot Week, beginning Monday, is mostly just for fun, but it also has a serious side. Scientists need to drum up donations for their long-running research into the rodents to keep it going through federal funding cuts. In some sense, we're going to be laughing our way down as the Titanic sinks, said Dan Blumstein, leader of the project, launched decades ago at the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory in Gothic, Colorado. Because what else are you going to do? A marmot is a cat-sized furry ground squirrel that lives and burrows in North America, Europe, and Asia. While hibernating bears snooze in a state called torpor, allowing them to wake up or be woken up every now and then, marmots slip into a far deeper form of hibernation. Their body temperature drops from about that of a human to as low as 41 degrees Fahrenheit, not much warmer than their burrows in winter. To prepare for winter, the animals do a tremendous amount of fattening. They double their weight to as much as 13 pounds, then lose all of that bulk during half a year or more of hibernation. Last winter, scant snowfall and warm temperatures due to global warming deprived many Colorado marmots of an insulating blanket of snow over their burrows. Researchers believe their hibernation quarters got too chilly, causing many to freeze. We had over 160 animals, and we ended with 60 at the start of this season, Blumstein said. Most of them died because of the lack of snow cover. This year's snowpack was the worst on record in the upper Colorado River Basin, which includes Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, and New Mexico. The study in Gothic, about 20 miles south of Aspen, is run by researchers from UCLA and the University of Ottawa in Ontario. It was launched in 1962, making it one of the world's longest-running studies of individual mammals. The marmot researchers affectionately call themselves marmoteers. It allows graduate students and other people to come in and suddenly capitalize on this knowledge and ask questions without doing all the grunt work, Blumstein said. Funding cuts have caused Blumstein's UCLA department to lose one-third of its graduate students. Fat Marmot Week is one approach to attract interest and hopefully donations to keep the work going. Among the rodents on display, Stonehenge, who chirps at mountain bikers, and Citron, whose mate is a leader of this matriarchal marmot motherland. Voting opens Monday. Trump threatens lawsuit over report he doesn't like. Dateline Washington. President Trump has opened a new front in his campaign to intimidate political foes, threatening a prominent liberal think tank with a $5 billion defamation lawsuit over a report concluding that his deployment of the National Guard to cities across the country has had little effect on reducing violent crime. And that looks like all the time that we have for today. Thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your weekend.